Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
Actually, my view is that conflict is a good thing. It's a healthy thing. And if you acknowledge when occasionally things aren't going well, you know, it's only out of dissatisfaction that we create new ways of working.
In her new book, How to Avoid Bedlam in the Boardroom and Boredom in the Bedroom, mediator Jane Gunn shows how the principles for dealing with conflict can be the same in a large commercial dispute or, let's just say, in the kitchen. What is perhaps most striking about this book by one of England's leading mediators is that it is intended for the general public, not just legal professionals. In the book, Jane draws on her years of experience with high-profile cases in order to provide practical guidance on how readers can identify difficult situations before they ripen into conflict. And when conflicts do arise, as they often do, she relies on powerful anecdotes to show how some parties have been able to transform their conflict from a potentially debilitating negative to a positive, bringing about changes in how they work and relate to each other, both in the boardroom and at home. We started our discussion with Jane explaining how she came up with the idea for the rather unusual title for her book, which occurred to her while preparing a workshop some years ago for some senior company executives and their spouses.
This title sprung into my mind, and how to beat bedlam in the boardroom and boredom in the bedroom. So I floated it to the group chair, and he said, "Oh, I'm really not sure about that. It sounds a bit risky." Anyway, we decided to go with it, and it was a hit. And the whole concept was I knew that I had to do this sort of dual function workshop to say, well, you know, both the chief executives are dealing with workplace conflicts and the partners at home are dealing with situations at home as well. Are there some common denominators, some common features and principles of conflict resolution that I can talk about? And in fact, there are, because, of course, you know, wherever you're dealing with conflict, the general principles that we use are the same, whether it's an international conflict or a conflict at home in the kitchen. And even halfway through the workshop, when we were stopping for a coffee, I said, you know, what would they like to cover next? They said, you know what we'd really like to cover next? We'd like to talk about how to deal with difficult teenagers. So I had them all role-playing teenagers. And in groups,
a bunch of CEOs who are role-playing teenagers,
and they had to be kind of smoking, drinking, you know, not doing what their parents wanted. And the other one had to role-play the parent. And how would you try and change someone's behavior in this kind of situation where they're doing things, they're behaving in ways you wouldn't want them to? So this was fantastic, and as I say, they're still talking about it now.
By the way, acting as a badly behaving teenager may not have been much of a stretch for some CEOs.
Oh, maybe that's the same. But they sure had to deal with their own teenagers, and untidy bedrooms were not the least of it.
Well, but it's interesting that your book is written by a mediator, but it's not a mediation guide. It's not a how-to book about how to do better mediations. It's not encouraging people to use mediation. Instead, it's the lessons that you've learned as a mediator, the things that you've observed, and how to help people apply this in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, ever since I came across mediation itself, I've realize that there's this what I call window of opportunity, that in fact as mediators we're dealing with disputes at the very back end, you know, late in their timeline, as it were, and that really we ought to be trying to practice early dispute resolution, catching disputes disputes while they're conflicts, before they've reached deadlock, and helping our clients and to resolve their issues at a much earlier stage. So early dispute resolution has been a passion of mine. And then thinking, well, if something isn't in litigation, I'm not really acting, or sometimes I'm acting as a mediator, but sometimes I'm just helping people to identify the skills to resolve those conflicts themselves. And, you know, if you can do that for businesses, whether it's in the boardroom or whether it's more generally in the workplace or whether it's business-to-business conflicts, if you can give them some of the tools, some of the principles that we use as mediators, they're well placed to begin to resolve their own disputes and then also to know at what stage they should invite a third party into that situation.
Right, but in most of the examples that you provide in your book, they're not cases that involve mediators. They're examples of workplace conflict or dissatisfaction and problems that the spouses may have at home, and how they can find ways to identify early on what the sources of their conflict are and how to overcome those difficulties.
Well, I think I go right back to basics in the book to say that most of our most conflicts arise from miscommunication. You know, we had an expectation about a situation, or we thought the outcome of a situation or of a conversation was going to be different, and therefore it's the expectation, the disappointment, which begins to cause the conflict, and that underneath most of that we have needs, issues, and interests, and needs, and concerns, and fears, which we haven't been able to communicate to the other person, and also we have these sort of attitudes and beliefs and so on that come from our past, from the moment we were born, that we've developed our own view of the world, and those are the things that people communicating with us, especially in the workplace, don't see and don't understand, and we don't often have the language to explain that or even know that it's of any relevance in the issue that we're trying to resolve.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I think is one of the overall themes of your book, too, is that, you know, very often we ourselves are not aware of some of the problems or some of the issues that we may have, or there are ways of perceiving the world. So we fail to communicate those things. We operate under certain assumptions that sometimes we may be only barely aware of.
Yeah, and there's a chapter in the book which I call An Island in Paradise, and I think that each of us from the moment we're born we create our own view of the world, and that view is based on our own attitudes and beliefs, which are made up of everything that's happened to us since we were born, things that happened to us at school, that views that our parents had. All of these are form a sort of a soup, if you like, and we accept or reject what we like, but that's the basis of our own individual views and beliefs, and we create this sort of world around us that forms a kind of safety barrier, if you like, or the foundation of what makes us feel safe and secure in the world, and we look out at the rest of the world from the safety of this island, and we don't really understand that people don't see what we see. That their view of the world, the place that they live, looks very different to them. And so we're slightly confused when we come across people who have very different views to ours as to how to understand where they come from or why they don't understand where we come from.
Yeah, you give a very good example of that, in fact, at one point. I think it's the where you have this senior executive who has I think it's on a board of directors, and there's a new board member who's a young up-and-coming woman director.
Yeah.
And he's very belittling towards her, very demeaning often of her ideas. And she's becoming increasingly disgruntled in the workplace, and she's probably going to leave the company. And he's completely unaware that he's totally demeaning in his approach towards her.
Yeah. And this is something that, I see a lot, but that people are unaware of how others perceive them. They don't know how their behavior is perceived, how it's seen or experienced by others, and until it's pointed out to them, and quite often they're horrified about that. But very often in the workplace, by the time they come to that realization, if they ever do, the damage is done, and staff dissatisfaction has grown, or dissatisfaction in the boardroom has grown, and all sorts of consequences have flown from that, and not least in a huge amount of expense to the organization, which is one of the things I'm very passionate about trying to save organizations, is huge amount of money that they often spend on sorting out these problems.
So how do you address that in that particular case? You're in the shoes of this woman director. Your boss is obviously, but he appears to be misogynistic. He's demeaning to you and everything, and all of the ideas that you present. What would be the way to address that problem?
Well, it may be that in that particular case, they would need a third party to help them communicate because, you know, like in every other case, what they're trying to do is to say, look, you know, the way your communication comes across to me is like this. I don't understand what you're trying to say to me. I don't understand how, or it doesn't make sense to me how you communicate. So just giving that basic information to someone that the way they communicate doesn't work and, you know, there might be a better way to communicate. Of course, the main problem in all communication is that our instinctive reaction has become defensive. If someone tells us that the way we're doing something doesn't work for them, before we take that as a piece of neutral feedback, we receive it as some criticism of ourselves and we respond in a defensive way. So that's why communication breaks down very often, is that we revert to our adversarial selves, I suppose.
So in that situation, to take it a step further, one obvious consequence is that the employee gets upset, she quits employment, and it may even be a lawsuit against the company. If we step back, however, and say, what can we do before it gets to that stage? I guess you would advise, well, even before you get to a mediator, it might be involving a third party, the director of human resources or someone else who can help create an environment of communications.
Yeah, so often a third party might be able to say to the male partner, you know, the way you come across to the female partner is like this. Did you have any idea that that's how she receives your message, that that's how she receives your communication? And in many instances, he would say, gosh, no, I had no idea that I come across as being sort of brusque or aggressive or whatever. It wasn't what I intended. I mean, maybe it is what he intended. But often if people are actually being aggressive in their communication, sometimes that's down to other factors like low self-esteem. You know, they maybe feel threatened by female partners and so on. So there's other issues going on under the surface that also could be explored.
But another example that you give is the one of again, a male-female difficulty with a partnership.
A male partner who really feels that his female partner actually, you know, while she's become a partner, he underneath actually his own value system believes that she actually should be at home with her child.
However, she's also dedicating a lot of time to child raising, right? She took some time off, she came back in, and now she hasn't been as, let's say, cold-hearted working as she was before.
That's right. So he's kind of taken aback by the change in her. I think that, you know, also underneath what this example is bringing out is that they have different value systems, that he comes from a religious background where the wife, the female would normally stay at home and look after the children. And so he's kind of fighting against that stereotype and what his own wife and his own mother have probably done. And yet he's got a female partner who is not of that background and therefore doesn't have the same belief system. And he's finding it hard to rationalize those two. And also he doesn't understand. He doesn't know that his partner is actually struggling with a child who has some other health issues at home. So that in fact, she's working very hard to juggle both her home life and her work life. And so for both of them, it's an inability to see what's actually going on under the surface for both of them and to acknowledge that maybe there are other ways to understand where the other's coming from without having to try and sort of demonize their views, as it were. But of course, the female partner is struggling with the work, home life issues. And I think she, if I remember this story correctly, actually has a husband at home who's maybe struggling with his own business. He's trying to get his own business off the ground. So in fact, her needs and interests are actually, I have to work. There is no other money coming into the house. And I need to work to be able to keep our family afloat. So this is a different situation and something which her male partner hasn't understood. So that bit hasn't been communicated. So this story is about, it's partly about where our view of the world comes and partly about understanding underlying needs and interests.
So how do they get out of this situation? Because it's just it's heading towards a difficult spiral where, you know, the more that she tries and feels conflicted, the worse that she feels, and obviously the less that she's producing in the office, the more that the other partner is going to feel that he's also getting the raw end of the deal.
Yes, and one of the things that they need to do is to feel that it's okay to understand where the other partner comes from without needing to try and persuade that partner that they need to change their mind. So one of the things that we often do as human beings when we feel challenged, particularly in terms of our fundamental beliefs, is that we try and defend those, and very often we try and change the minds of other people to reflect our own views and beliefs. So, you know, this is often what we do in terms of religion, but other things that we espouse, whether it's vegetarianism or whatever, you know, where you find people out campaigning, trying to change other people's minds. And so in this kind of case, the partners need to understand that it isn't about trying to change the other person's view, but simply helping them to understand that they don't need to have exactly the same view, and also that going on underneath are needs and interests that are quite fundamental to them and can't be changed. You know, they need to earn the money, and of course they need to keep the business on track, and understanding what their priorities are and how they're going to meet those priorities is also important.
Well, is this a case that you, or similar to a case that you mediated in real life?
I've mediated, yes, a number of cases like this in real life, and they're not legal mediations in that legal action hasn't started, but there is a need for a mediator to come in and, you know, help the parties first of all to understand where their own behavior is coming from or where the conflict has arisen from, and then to help them look at what are the options, what are the different options that we have for resolving this without it escalating and becoming more expensive for the business.
Do you find parties coming to you earlier on before they actually head into a dispute to help them sort through their issues?
Yeah, much more, Mike. And it's one of the things that I'm really passionate about is people coming to me at a much earlier stage and saying, you know, hey, we've got something that's really not quite right. We're afraid that it may brew up into something which is much more serious, or a legal dispute may resolve. Can you come and help us now? And that's really the best time for me to go and help them to understand where the miscommunications come from and understand what they can do about it. You're really not talking about negotiating deals. You're not talking about negotiating financial outcomes here. You are literally negotiating people's relationships, their way of working together. And the ultimate aim is to restore the working relationship and get the business back on track and save all those hours of lost productivity and all the potential legal fees that they might have spent if this thing had escalated out of control.
And how do you get people to do that? How do you get people? I guess your book is one way of getting them there, right? Encouraging them, showing them that if you can straighten things out earlier on, or begin to realign them earlier on, then you might avoid the bigger problems down the road.
I think that's a big reason for me writing the book. Actually, my view is that conflict is a good thing. It's a healthy thing. It happens in all organizations. And if you didn't have conflict, you'd never have those opportunities to create even more value out of your working relationships, because you can find better ways to do things and better ways to work together if you acknowledge when occasionally things aren't going well. Now, it's only out of dissatisfaction that we create new ways of working.
So the book is to help people also feel to not feel threatened by conflict, to address it positively and to try to find the best way forward.
Absolutely, right. Yes.
When's the book coming out?
The book will be out in January 2010, so that's only a few weeks away.
Do you have a price for it?
I don't have a price for it yet. No, but it'll be moderately priced. I'm sure it'll be. The aim is that it should be available on, you know, for example, at airport bookshelves, so that people can pick it up. It's not a heavy read. It's quite a light read, so that it could be read in the space of a short airplane journey or a train journey. Or in bed, of course.
Or in the boardroom.
Or in the boardroom.
All right, Jim. Well, thank you. Good luck with the book. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.